Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Portfolio manager Kyle Weaver joins us again today. Kyle brings a value-driven approach to growth investing to his fund, Fidelity U.S. Growth Opportunities Class, which was launched for Canadian investors in January 2020. In speaking with host Pamela Ritchie, Kyle reflects on 2020 and how his fund was positioned and performed during the market volatility in March and April. Kyle touches on how he looks at secular trends and where society is transitioning rather than the market cycles. He looks at a 3 to 5 year horizon for companies, but that are currently trading at a reasonable price. Kyle also explains his sell philosophy and shares his thoughts on digitization and innovation. Today's podcast was recorded on January 27th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
So great to see you, Kyle.
Good to see you, Pamela.
Glad to have you join us here today. Let's go back in time. Launching this fund, how were you positioned? What were the themes that you were trying to invest around, not knowing that the pandemic was around the corner?
Yeah, I definitely did not know that the pandemic was around the corner. It was a pre-pandemic portfolio. A lot of the names that went into this fund were names that had been developed and not surprisingly were, you know, names that I'd invested in from the US funds that I'd run for a number of years and reflected my focus on secular themes, long duration secular themes, and finding winners in those spaces with good business models that'll prove to be cheap over the fullness of time, usually, you know, 3 to 7 years. And it was not a fund that was positioned for a pandemic. It did turn out to be a fund that was fairly well positioned for the behavior changes that the pandemic set off. And, you know, those weren't clear to many of us, certainly weren't clear to me in the early stages of the pandemic. But, you know, for a number of these kind of secular winners in areas like e-commerce, electronic payments, electric vehicles, the pandemic accelerated trends and accelerated changes in behavior that actually benefited many of the business models that the fund was positioned in. So I guess it's better to be lucky than good sometimes. I mean, I did feel like I needed to re-examine the investment thesis for every single thing that I owned, because the world had clearly changed. But it was uncanny how many of the business models I was positioned in turned out to actually benefit from the behavior changes that took place. And I think also, I don't believe it's possible to predict the macro. Part of my investment philosophy is that it's very difficult to predict the macro or the market. And a byproduct of that is I tend not to have very many macro sensitive stocks in the fund. And right. That also insulated the fund to some extent during, at least from a fundamental perspective, many of the fund's holdings during those crazy weeks of March and April.
They were. It's sort of, I think we're all still digesting them to an extent. Let's go into some of the sort of process that got you to where you had invested in those companies a year ago. You're calling it a deep value approach, but to growth investing. So I wonder if you can just kind of break that down for us. What's that mean?
Yeah, I'd love to. It's pretty simple, actually. It just means that I am looking for business models that are growing and that will prove to be extremely cheap over the fullness of time. I really do want to be paying a deep value type multiple for any business model that I buy the nuance, what I guess is different from what you traditionally think of as a deep value investor, is I am looking forward to the future value of the business model rather than backwards or necessarily at a notion of present value or near-term value. So many of the stocks that I might own could look expensive, but you know, when you go back, most growth stocks, many good growth stocks looked expensive at the time they were bought, and now they look, you know, absurdly cheap. If you look at Apple when they first came out with the iPhone in 2007, you split adjusted, it's a $3 or $4 stock back then, and today they're expected to earn more than $4 next year. So, you know, you were really paying less than 1x earnings if you bought it and held it for the next 13 years. But the same is true for other stocks, and you don't have to go out that long. But that is the general idea, is trying to buy stocks at a low, very low multiple of free cash flow or earnings out into the future.
And that sort of eventually get to look like growth stocks on a more perhaps normal basis, if you want to call it that. I mean, I've heard you say in the past that in some ways you wish a lot of stocks were kind of misunderstood gems. Can you kind of go into the thinking behind that, or what you see in some of those moments, those stocks, when you approach them?
Yeah, well, so I do think of... I think of my fund, dividing the names up in the fund, kind of into three buckets. And you know, the first bucket, the main bucket, would be the well-known stocks and index components that make up the fund's benchmark, the blue chip growers, the long-term growers, that everyone would recognize. And those are names that have been recognized with, you know, multi-$100 billion valuations or $1 trillion valuations as winners in the space. And there's always a certain amount of the fund that is invested in those, as you might expect. The fund sometimes comes from looking for ideas in two of the other baskets. One of the baskets, is, I call it value growers or resilient growth stocks. And the third basket, and the most fun, are the breakthrough growers. And those are the ones that, those tend to be smaller companies that will hopefully be the blue chippers of tomorrow, of the you know, 5 years or 10 years from now. But at the time of investment, they are smaller companies growing very quickly in very large markets with customers that love them and you know, and good management teams that have big ambitions for what the company can become over time. And that's where you just, you know, a good example of maybe a stock that's gone from a breakthrough grower to now, I think, the blue chip growth would be Tesla, which, you know, 5 or 10 years ago was still seen as a very speculative, kind of unprofitable, wacky battery car maker. And now I think is recognized, you know, with a almost $1 trillion market cap as kind of a long-term winner in a secular growth area of the $20 trillion auto industry that has, you know, decades of kind of market share growth ahead of it. So does that answer your question there?
Absolutely. And I was just going to say, when you mentioned through sort of those heady days of March and so on, and you had to relook at all of the stocks within the fund, it must have also been a time to find some of those misunderstood gems, I'm assuming.
Oh, that was the best time to find those misunderstood gems. You know, one, and I didn't really mention this before, but if the core underlying philosophy of my stock selection is to find growth stocks that will prove to be extremely cheap, the core underlying philosophy of my portfolio construction is to always be prepared for the unexpected, to always be able to take advantage of volatility. And I never necessarily expect volatility, but you sort of expect the unexpected. So maybe I do. In any case, in March and April, you know, again, I was not ahead of the curve on understanding the full ramifications of the pandemic, but when as the market plummeted and investors kind of panicked generally, there were a lot of business models that you could make a decent case were probably going to come out okay from this. And just as an example, it seems obvious now in retrospect, but the e-commerce models and kind of the e-commerce specialists and in areas like, you know, used cars or home furnishings with a Wayfair or a Carvana, you know, their competition in the physical world had been shut down, which really advantaged their position as an e-commerce player and strengthened the trends towards towards e-commerce in the industries they were participating in. You know, for Tesla, which I think was their biggest purchase in the fund during that March and April period, you know, that they had just done a opportunistic capital raise the month earlier in February. So went into the kind of these economic shutdowns with an extremely robust cash-rich balance sheet and with production ramping in a kind of supply constrained environment for their cars. And so we were able to take it, you know, as that stock got cut in half in an environment when Tesla's competitors probably felt, you know, more constrained, more worried about investing in their own EV efforts and autonomous driving efforts because of the duress that their traditional businesses were in. You know, I thought that was a great example of a business that was probably being advantaged by what was going on. You know, they have a direct sales model. You don't have to go to a dealership to buy the cars. And all of that was happening in the context of a stock that was down 50%. So it, for example, that was an example of one name that we really tried to take advantage of the volatility in. You know, and through the remainder of the year, it went up.
So you mentioned almost off the top that macro is not where you really look for the signals for things that you're looking for. But with that said, does it matter which part of a cycle we're in for you? I mean, do you look at it in terms of the beginning of something that ramps up? Do you see us in early cycle? Is that useful to you to look at things that way?
I think it would be useful if I thought I could find the answer and bet on it. But I just, for me, I find it more useful to spend that time looking for business models where the point in the cycle that we're in the broad economic cycle, doesn't matter. I care much more about where we are in the cycle of the particular secular trend that is playing out to benefit that business model. So, you know, I care much more about where are we in the cycle of the transition from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles. Where are we in the cycle from shifting advertising dollars from traditional media to the internet? Where are we in the cycle from people watching linear TV to watching TV over the internet? All of those, I think, are the cycles that I'm more interested in. And so I really try to be as kind of bottoms up as possible in looking at cycles.
Do any of those cycles that you just mentioned, do any of them swing back? Or is it just in the direction that we've sort of seen? Because there's a lot that's been pulled forward, so-called, over the course of the last sort of year in terms of transitions to digitization. I mean, do certain things go back, or are we in a world of digitization?
Well, that's the big question, and I think it does depend exactly where you're looking. It reminds me, you know, I think of when I say, oh, you know, I ended up owning a lot of kind of COVID beneficiaries. Well, I didn't own all of them. You know, I didn't own Clorox, and I still don't own Clorox. And, you know, the narrative around these cycles will often dictate what is happening to the stocks and what the price is. I think it depends business model to business model, company to company. But I think for many of the trends, when you look at a secular trend that had already been in place for years or decades and then was accelerated, it does, in general, to make a gross maybe overgeneralization, it seems less likely to me that that will reverse, which is a little different maybe from, you know, a cycle of a less secularly driven cycle, like, for example, you know, how much bleach you have in your home. I mean, to me, that seems like there's probably a mini cycle of, we all have more bleach than we used to have, and you know, there's probably a limit to how much bleach and toilet paper all of us can hoard. So it depends.
It doesn't smell good. Yeah, we'll have to maybe yeah, we can come down on that just a little bit. Well, we'll see. Tell us a little bit about your sell discipline. You mentioned volatility and how you use it. I think more on kind of an entry basis. Tell us a little bit about your sell philosophy.
The sell philosophy relates to the buy philosophy. And I'm not dodging the question, I'll get there, but the buy philosophy is to find names that can double or triple over a 3 to 7 year period of time and use volatility to our advantage. The sell philosophy is based on the same thing. I mean, if a stock goes up, if a stock that you bought because it could double or triple over a 3 to 7 year period of time, if it doubles or triples in 6 months, you know, you do need to, there may be something there that means your initial estimate of what value could be in 5 years was off, and maybe the story is even better than you supposed. But if it's the same and the stock is up, and it's, you know, you for me, that's a signal that it doesn't need to be as big of a position. And luckily in a diversified fund, you know, across sectors, there's almost always something that's out of favor. So, you know, as e-commerce winners maybe are getting bid up, well, there may be some interesting healthcare plays that have fallen out of favor. And so trying to optimize for long-term returns through kind of the daily, monthly, weekly price fluctuations is a big part of how I try to keep the fund positioned, and hence also part of kind of the sell discipline. I mean, it is determined by how much return I think there is left over the next 3 to 7 years.
Maybe you've implicitly answered this, but does digitization have to be in every company that you invest in? Is that just a given at this point?
I think it would be hard to find a company that didn't have digitization as some part of its fundamental bottoms-up story. I mean, even in the least kind of digital sector or sub-industry I could think of to test whether you could totally ignore digitization in that. I really had trouble thinking of one. Even in healthcare, you know, the initial what started out as electronic health records, but now are coming together as next generation healthcare providers that are bringing physical assets and actual employees and cutting edge technology to provide better care for patients. You know, that relies on digitization. Even when you think about something like electric vehicles, I mean, they're essentially computers on wheels. That's digitization. And even in something boring like, I shouldn't say boring, but a sector like consumer staples, you know, digitization is now a huge way that new entrants can come to market by using the power of the internet to go directly to consumers and create new brands through platforms like Facebook and Google, rather than, you know, through slotting fees at grocery stores. Right. And so I think it touches everything. And it's hard to, you know, it's hard for me to find examples of stocks where it's not a relevant investment concern or investment or investment thesis.
Got a number of questions coming in here, Kyle. We'll try and get to as many as we can. So how do you look at people working from home impacting commercial business going forward? What are your thoughts on sort of that dynamic?
For me, it's not a dynamic I have a strong view on. I'm aware of the fact that lots of people have lots of strong views on it. Like I just don't. Again, it's a little, for me, it falls into the kind of too hard category, like figuring out where interest rates and oil and you know, when reopening is going to happen occurs. So again, it's just not, I apologize that I don't have a better answer for that, but it's not something I haven't thought about. It's something I've thought about and concluded, gosh, I need to find, you know, investment ideas that don't really depend on a strong view about how, you know, working from home will affect the business model over time. I mean,
Tell us a little carry on. Well, I was going to ask another question that's coming in with, you know, give us a sense of the number of holdings that you've got. I think it's sort of up to 200. They fit into different buckets, as you mentioned. How do you keep on top of them all? I mean, it's quite a large number. Can you comment one way or the other?
Yeah, well, definitely. I think the number is a little deceiving to start with. There are... there's a number of there are some private holdings, and there's every different share class gets counted as a different name, and then there are a number of very early stage biotech companies that are that may be a very small portion of the fund. I, you know, it's not the 200 something positions are not spread evenly like peanut butter. One thing I try to do is keep 90% of the fund in the top 90 bets. So that, you know, you kind of get the benefits of my pressure test for just making sure you're taking, you know, enough kind of concentrated bets. In terms of keeping track of them, though, you know, luckily the number of names in the fund I've noticed kind of expands with the duration of time. And part of the reason is oftentimes I will not want to leave a best idea, even if it, for example, becomes too expensive to be kind of a new money idea. And I hold on to some small amount of some positions in case, you know, there gets to be another opportunity in those names. And you just gradually, you learn more and more ideas. And many of those you want to keep a relationship with the company, build on your knowledge of the business model. And so that you're ready when, you know, when volatility strikes, when the stock is down, 50% for transitory reasons, that you're ready to take advantage of that and try to find names that can, you know, triple or quadruple or better, you know, over a reasonable period of time.
So
we also have a fabulous research department that really helps us stay on top of names. For pretty much all of the biotech names in there are in there for reasons that rely very heavily on the research in on our healthcare team. And you know, when it comes to the private market, we have an equity capital markets team that helps a lot with those. But everything that's in there is in there for a reason, and I think hopefully fits the criteria of a business model that could prove to be extremely cheap over 3 to 7 years.
So I'll just pick up on that, over 3 to 7 years. So at this point, I guess it's fair to think that all those ideas, or are all those ideas, for a post-COVID world, or can you make that connection?
Yeah, I mean, we are in a post-COVID world. I mean, well, hopefully it's like it to really be post-COVID. I guess we're still kind of in the pan-COVID world. But yes, they are, you know, anything that depends, the nuance though is that I think anything that really depends on a clear and specific view of what a post-COVID world looks like, I think I would have trouble underwriting, you know, with great specificity. So, you know, I still, for example, do not own airlines, not because I think people will never fly again, but until they do, those business models are hemorrhaging cash, and I don't have a clear view on when sort of air travel will get back close to normal. But, you know, and so for those business models, I think you have to have kind of a view on when it'll happen, not just if it'll happen, because they're losing money until it does. For other names, you know, I think you can kind of sit back if they're making money now, and if it's a food distributor, for example, you don't have to have as specific of a view about what a post-COVID world looks like. And the business model stands as a sound business model with secular tailwinds, you know, sort of regardless of the specific contours of how reopening plays out. Does that make sense?
It does. We're going to eat for sure after post-COVID, and probably we'll fly too, but the food for sure. Let's talk just a little bit about, I mean, again, you don't like macro, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Do we underestimate just how the amount of innovation that we might be walking into, say, 5 years from now? I mean, do you see the seeds planted at this point for, you know, just a high wall of innovation going forward?
Absolutely. I mean, there is an incredible amount of innovation unfolding as we speak. Some of it, I think, is potentially reflected in the market. I mean, I think that is why you've seen the success that Tesla has had as a stock, not just as a company this year. I mean, that is, I think, a well-appreciated business model at this point. But there are still, you know, there's so much innovation going on, and it is hard to sometimes guess, you know, how great can be over a 3 or 5 year time horizon, which is why I try to, you know, I try to stay away from a very precise estimate of value out over that period of time. But I think it's very important to have a rough notion of what the value could be over that period of time. because to your point, it's hard to know exactly, you know, how good GREAT can be, and you know, whether it's hydrogen fuel cells or clean energy and renewables through residential solar, battery grid management, all sorts of things that are sort of happening as we speak. It's difficult to, it's more important to get the direction right than the exact kind of precise location of the endpoint.
Kyle, as a final thought, what would you, any message you want to leave investors with, just as you wrap out your conversation here today?
Just, you know, thank you for your confidence in the fund so far. I think this past year was kind of a good example of how I hope to run the fund going forward in terms of, you know, taking advantage of volatility when it occurs. And I, you know, want to be very clear that there will be periods of volatility and it hurts as it happens. But, it, you know, the way I hope to partner with investors in the fund, and I am is to be able to take advantage of that and, you know, find good business models that'll be much bigger over the fullness of time. So, you know, thank you.
Kyle Weaver, thank you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Pamela.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you tomorrow.